From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, a document uncovered from the Cuomo administration's assessment of the health impacts of hydrofracking says the gas drilling process is likely safe if proper precautions are taken. Our political observer Alan Shartok will share his thoughts on that news, and we'll take a look at one way the healthcare industry is rapidly transforming in New York. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. A document from Governor Cuomo's administration assessing the health impacts of hydrofracking, written several months ago, says the gas drilling process is likely safe if proper precautions are taken by the governor's environmental agency. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The document, obtained by New York State Public Radio and other news organizations, outlines potential health risks associated with hydrofracking in New York. Those include possible exposure to chemicals used in fracking, potential contamination of drinking water sources, and health impacts from naturally occurring radium that could be brought to the surface through the gas drilling process. While the report says there are potential health risks involved in hydrofracking, it concludes that in each instance, proper mitigation measures that will be required by the State Department of Environmental Conservation will minimize any potential harm and reduce risks. The report, written in February of 2012, nearly a year ago, says significant adverse impacts on human health are not expected from routine hydrofracking operations. The report appears to have been intended to be included in the state's ongoing environmental review of fracking. A spokeswoman for the DEC says the report is outdated and that no conclusion should be drawn. The state's health commissioner is currently reviewing health data from the DEC with the help of three nationally known experts. Little is known about what the data contains. Here's what Governor Cuomo said about the health study when asked in mid-December.
They're looking at the experiences of other states in the country where this has been done, reports of possible health consequences, whether or not it's true, what remediation was done, what protections were taken there, and they will then help us make a determination whether or not there is a true health risk or not.
The DEC spokeswoman, Emily DeSantis, says the health experts are reviewing the entire draft environmental impact statement, which has not yet been released to the public. Catherine Natta, with Environmental Advocates, says she hopes the health experts are looking at much more than what's contained in the February 2012 document.
I hope Governor Cuomo is going to stand by his word on this and to really rely on the public health experts and address the questions that they raise and make any decisions on fracking, you know, based on that. But if this is the final, then we could be in a lot of trouble.
In September, NATO submitted a Freedom of Information request to view all existing reports on the health impacts of hydrofracking written by either the Cuomo administration's health department or environmental agency. She was told a diligent search was underway and that a response could not be given until the end of January. A spokesman for the industry group, the Independent Oil and Gas Association, says the February 2012 report appears to employ common sense. IOGA spokesman Jim Smith says with proper precautions, any potential risks from fracking will be minimized. A spokeswoman for the State Health Department says there's no definitive deadline for when the health review will be finished. Governor Cuomo continues to say he wants all of the science and facts before he makes a final decision. Here's more of what he said in the mid-December interview.
This issue has big consequences on both sides. If there's a concern that it might damage the environment, which would be very detrimental, there's a hope that it would generate jobs on the plus side. So it's big consequences, a lot of emotion, and what we've said all along is the process is what's most important now.
Cuomo, when asked Wednesday about the state's ongoing review of hydrofracking, said there's nothing new. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Well, Alan, this week, lots to talk to you about. Let's start with hydraulic fracturing. Yep. And we see the New York Times, our Karen DeWitt, both reporting that the State Health Department found in an analysis over a year ago, just about a year ago, that the hydraulic fracturing for natural gas could be conducted safely in New York if the proper precautions were taken by the state DEC. Meanwhile, the spokesman for the State Department of Environmental Conservation in New York, Emily DeSantis, says that this analysis obtained by the Times is out of date. Quote, the document you have is merely a summary, is nearly a year old, and there will be substantial changes to that version. She added that a revised version of the environmental impact statement on hydrofracking, which last ran about 1,500 pages, would include more material delving into the health issues. The administration also turned to three outside experts to review the state's own health assessments. Meantime, we have seen that, number one, the folks in the southern tier to have hydrofracking there is the most likely result of this. This also in the Times article. But you've been predicting since the very beginning, Alan, that the writing has been on the wall, and certainly this document unveiled would lead to that assessment.
That's right, David. Look, this governor has been doing some good things. I think his leadership on gun control, for example, is very healthy. I haven't been able to read the entire report from his committee on education, but much of it seems like it's very sensible. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. On the other hand, I am concerned about this because I said, as you have just indicated from the beginning, that the deal was cut, that he was going to go for the fracking. I think what happened was that he was astounded, as were the people around him, by the vocalness of the opponents to the fracking. Now, I say, with that said, you know, here's a governor with a 74% approval rating. And so clearly people are waiting to see before they turn on him, the fracking folks. They think he's doing basically a good job. But I'll tell you, it isn't the question of whether or not somebody votes for it so they can get a little bit of extra money, the people in the southern tier. The real question is, how come you say to the people of New York City, don't worry, we're not going to allow them to frack anywhere near your water supply, or the people in Syracuse, oh, yeah, they have this excuse, technical excuse or that, and then say, but if you happen to live somewhere, and there are a lot of folks in this bag near the southern tier, and your neighbors want the money for their land, that your kid has to drink the water that may be compromised. It's that simple. It is one of the reasons why fracking is so opposed by members of the legislature, particularly in the assembly, and by an awful lot of people who are taking the lead. After all, the one thing that the United States has that so many other countries don't have, that New York has, that so many other states don't have, is water. And you want to assure the purity of the water. If you have enough people at the DEC who are going to inspect every one of these wells, and if you are sure that the casings are going to hold, and if you're sure that the reports of seismic activity, earthquakes, are misplaced, okay, that's one thing. But until we know that, it is virtual suicide to go ahead with it. And that is something that doesn't get done by a plebiscite, by a small group of people who may want the money.
Not to mention, we've heard in the past, at least, that the Department of Environmental Conservation in New York doesn't have enough staff to monitor these kinds of regulations.
You're exactly right, David. You have to have enough people who are going to do the checking on this. And if you've taken an awful lot of people out of the DEC, which happened not only on Cuomo's watch, but before Cuomo with Pataki, you know, you really have a lot of explaining to do at the point at which somebody wants to set up a well, and somebody has to watch it as well as approve it in the first place.
Let's go to guns. You mentioned it before, and supporting Governor Cuomo's efforts, we heard that there might be a special session. Now, obviously, we're into the new year. We will have the State of the State address next week. And, you know, hints coming out that the governor wants the toughest gun law in the nation here in New York. Your comments on that. And then there's a side thing going on in New York where we see one newspaper publish the addresses and names of people who had gun permits in Westchester County area. And now the Putnam County folks, the county and the state senator Greg Ball, a Republican,
say they're not going to provide the information to that newspaper.
Oh, yes, they are. It may have to go to the courts, but Bob Freeman, the esteemed COPAR man, the Committee on Open Access, says it's the law and they have to do it. Now, like other demagogues, Greg Ball can get up there and he can try to yell about a newspaper and call it names and all the rest of it, but he won't win. He may win in that some of the gun people will say, good for you, Greg, at least you've tried to put a stop to it, but you didn't succeed. But I can tell you this right now, that they will succeed. Now, guns are terribly frightening instruments. If they're around, we know that there have been times when people during domestic arguments have turned on each other, somebody's been shot, you don't have a gun, you don't have the same thing. I've been getting mail from some of the gun adherents, and some of it has a sort of a dark tinge to it, and I don't know what to make of it, but I certainly understand the fact that there is a guard being posted at the Journal's front door, and ironically, I don't even know if that person has a gun or not. But this thing has gotten out of hand. Andrew Cuomo is exactly right on this. New York has to be the top state, but we all know that it is not a state problem. Guns travel over state lines. People can buy them very easily in some of the other states. They come in and they bring them here, and we find them all over the streets. That has to stop. And the only way to stop that is a national law. And even then, I don't know if you can stop it. Because, of course, the Supreme Court, the very right-wing Supreme Court, the very partisan, politically partisan Supreme Court, has made it clear that the Second Amendment is what the gun folks want it to say. And so it's going to be a very, very tough road to make anything stick. We understand that there are over 300 million guns in the United States. And those are the ones we know about. There are a lot of them that we don't know about. My house does not have a gun in it. And I think that that goes for an awful lot of other places. But you've got one hell of a lobby when you have 300 million people, or even half of that, who own guns and who are furious about the fact that you're going to take them away. The guns give them a sense of security. Some people would think a false sense of security. In order to have a gun in your house, there are those who have to be a little paranoid to begin with to get a gun. And when you try to take it away from them, it just confirms their views. I had a letter recently from a man, long, long, long letter, comparing the government to the Gestapo and the SS, which murdered people, and as if this government is the same as that government. You have to reach pretty hard to make that kind of an argument. All I can say is the further we get from the terrible massacre that we saw in Connecticut, the further we get from that, the more likely it is that there will be less action, which is why Cuomo is asking for it now, and he's right to do so.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The U.S. government has successfully averted the fiscal cliff for now, sidestepping big income tax increases for most Americans. The Senate approved the measure on a vote of 89-8, and it went on to the House, passing on a bipartisan vote of 257-167. Despite the 11th-hour agreement, taxes will rise. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas talked to local leaders and observers around the state have been weighing in on the budget deal. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas takes a look now at how Albany Region congressmen voted.
The budget deal passed by the U.S. Senate would raise taxes on about 77% of U.S. households, mostly because of the expiration of a payroll tax cut, according to preliminary estimates from the nonpartisan Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center in Washington. Robertson Williams is a spokesman for the center.
Households with incomes below $450,000 will see higher taxes almost entirely because of the expiration of the payroll tax cut. Their take-home pay, the first paychecks in January, will shrink by about 2% as the 2 percentage point payroll tax cut expired. For high-income people, taxes will go up because of higher rates on regular income, a 39.6% top tax bracket, higher taxes on capital gains and dividends, and new taxes associated with Obamacare.
The fiscal cliff deal makes the so-called Bush-era tax cuts, the permanent rates, the FICA payroll tax returns to 6.2%. Republican Congressman Chris Gibson stresses the importance of both political parties coming together to address the nation's long-term deficit situation.
9 months ago, I voted for a budget that does just that, the Cooper-LaTourette budget, which is based on the framework from the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Reduction Commission, chartered by the president. And I think that both parties, we need to get serious and get this done. The country's counting on us.
Democratic Congressman Paul Tonko also voted for the legislation.
While I would concede it's not perfect, it's the right thing to do. And I believe it's essential that we not have taxes rise for our hardworking middle class families. That population, our middle class, we have taken it on the chin. And I believe that, you know, there needed to be this better balance that came into play. So the measure ensures more fairness, more equality in the tax code, all while extending pro-growth, pro-business, and pro-jobs policies. And I think that as we continue that steady climb upward after 33 consecutive months of private sector job growth, this will enable us to build more deeply the confidence in the economy by allowing for this available resource to be reinvested into the community. I think it's a shot in the arm for the economy.
Congressman Gibson acknowledges that most workers will still be paying more in taxes, which he says is better than the alternative.
Had we not reached this agreement, there would have been an additional $2,500 taken out from our constituents at about that same kind of pay level. So, I mean, that's a fact. So it was important to vote for this to make sure that my constituents get to keep more of their take-home pay. With regard to Social Security tax, of course, that's the individual retirement that our constituents have. So, you know, that is money that they're going to get when they retire.
The Tax Policy Center's Robertson Williams sees the permanent tax code as the legislation's silver lining.
The last 12 years, we've had a temporary tax code with taxes changing virtually every year as the Bush tax cuts phased in. The Obama tax cuts were added in 2009. Everything was extended in 2012, but they've been temporary. Each has had an expiration date. Now the bulk of the tax code is permanent and doesn't have a date at which it will expire. We won't have to go through the same kind of last-minute, will they or won't they extend the tax cuts, and worry about will our taxes go up substantially once we pass the deadline.
Though its focus was on taxes, the measure approved Tuesday would prevent a $900 salary increase for members of Congress in March, as well as prevent a potential doubling of milk prices. The legislation also continues expanded unemployment benefits for an estimated 2 million jobless and delays automatic spending cuts for 2 months.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The health industry in upstate New York is undergoing some rapid transformations. Imagine using your smartphone to avoid getting the flu. A new mobile app designed by researchers at the University of Rochester sifts through Twitter feeds and alerts users to who around them might be contagious. The Innovation Trail's Kate O'Connell has more.
Twitter is already used to communicate with friends, interact with celebrities, and build social lives online. But one researcher at the University of Rochester has found a way to use the popular site to track disease outbreaks.
There's really no product like this that enables you to understand how these millions of people feel every second, because they self-report on their activities and they self-report on their health.
That's Adam Sadalek, a postdoctoral research fellow and the mind behind the Germ Tracker app, an app that aims to unlock the mystery of the spread of infectious diseases, like the flu. So here's how it works. Most people on Twitter have an open profile, which means their feeds are available to anyone, including researchers like Sadalek. The Germ Tracker program sifts through open tweets looking for words and phrases that might indicate a flu-like illness. And according to Sadalek, it's getting pretty good at it.
It has about 2 million features that it considers for any given sentence. So it has a giant checklist of things to look for. And says, you know, is this phrase here? Did I use slang? And then, based on the evaluation, it decides what is the probability of sickness.
But for the app to really be useful, tweeters have to have enabled the GPS on their computer or mobile device, because that's how Germ Tracker is able to plot their position on a map. The idea is to be able to track the spread of infectious diseases based on the location of users and their interactions in the community.
So you see your location, you know, at the center of the screen, and then the Twitter users colored from red to green, from sick to healthy. So you see immediately who has been around you, right, if they tweeted recently, and then you can click on these individuals and see what they tweeted about.
Red dots on the map represent people the algorithm has labeled as sick, and green dots are people who are healthy, or simply not tweeting about their health. Click on a red dot, and you might get something like this.
So let's see, it's like a random person. So this individual says, seriously, the stomach flu really sucks.
Satellite concedes the program isn't perfect. People using Twitter tend to be younger, and not everyone tweets about their health. But he says it's still the first model to give real-time data at such a fine level, and it has one unique quality. The information it generates can lead users to modify their behavior and potentially avoid illness. The Centers for Disease Control says it recognizes the use of social media for data collection has huge potential. But so far, it hasn't developed any policies about using that kind of information. Physician Lewis Papa says the app could allow public health organizations to track where large-scale epidemics begin and what sort of interactions cause them to spread.
So if you can imagine, if we had something like bird flu, the social media can be a huge tool to say, oh, how can we isolate this? Where did this originally start? Where is it traveling to? I mean, I think that can be enormously helpful.
Adam Sadalek says this is the next big step for him. He wants to be able to link the interactions of sick and healthy users to generate data on the probability of infection. The end goal? A smartphone that could warn you how likely you are to catch the flu if you spend time in a certain building or take the 7:15 a.m. bus to work.
So this sounds sci-fi, but now it's actually possible in places that have a lot of Twitter activity.
The app is available for mobile devices across the US, but Sadalek says the project is still in the beta phase. He says user feedback will help with the next stage of development. In Rochester, I'm Kate O'Connell for the Innovation Trail.
Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between five upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at innovationtrail.org. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number again, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1301. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.